And when you see someone who's acting out on the street, who's having a mental health crisis, I watched a guy who was having a mental health crisis walking down the middle of Julian, which is the street that we're on. And there was a police car behind him on their speaker saying, get out of the road, while this person is walking down the street screaming and yelling. You know, and I'm thinking to myself, well, that's helpful. That's a good de-escalation technique. Like, that person's behavior went from not good to like really, really crazy, you know, because they're being yelled at on a speaker in the middle of the street.
Behind the headlines and beyond the statistics lie the real stories of Northern California. Welcome to Voices of the Community, where we explore the challenges, celebrate the triumphs, and amplify the voices often unheard. From April 2020 to January 2023, we produced a 105-episode series spotlighting the challenges and resilience of nonprofits during the COVID-19 pandemic. In that time, we saw what was possible. State and local governments provided temporary housing for unhoused neighbors amid a global health crisis. Now, with the Supreme Court ruling allowing cities to ban public sleeping and San Francisco facing a $790 million budget deficit, we stand at a critical crossroads. In this live show, we reconnect with five dedicated organizations from our COVID-19 special series to see where they are today and explore the solutions they envision for supporting our unhoused neighbors. Join us for this powerful conversation as these leaders share insights, solutions, and the support they need. We invite you to consider how each of us can contribute to a city, state, and nation where everyone has a place to call home.
George Koster from Voices of the Community. Welcome to our Finding Home show here at Intersection for the Arts. All right, so I'm going to start with asking each of our panelists to introduce themselves, talk a little bit about why they work in the space they're working, and more about their organizations, what their organizations do, how their organizations support our unhoused community members. So I'm going to first turn to Mary.
My name is Mary Carl. I'm the executive director for Miracle Messages. For about the past 20 years, I've been working at the intersection of homelessness and health, going from overseeing a homeless program in Alameda County to leading efforts around the intersection and doing sector change work around health, public health, and community health and homelessness. And I was really drawn to Miracle Messages because of the work that it's doing that really looks at the whole person. And that the organization was really built from the community identifying what they needed. And the organization was able to build that service around that. And so our organization has been in work, it started here in San Francisco and has been existing for the last 10 years. And we're looking at reestablishing and restoring relationships for our unhoused community members. And we do that through three main programs. We support individuals in reuniting with their family and their loved ones. Both individuals who are reuniting with their loved ones who are experiencing homelessness, and then also those family members who've lost their loved one to homelessness, and we support people across the country doing that. We also do this through a vast network of volunteers who are key to our organization. The next thing that we do within our organization is not everybody is ready to reunite with their family and loved ones, and so we support individuals in establishing what we call like a digital pen pal, a miracle friend. And so we have housed community members across the country who are able to become like a digital pen pal with our unhoused community members and are able to establish a relationship that exists through phone calls, text messaging, and if the stars align, they're able to meet each other in person. And then the third part of our organization is focused on providing basic income to individuals to provide them with the space and the opportunity to be able to establish those relationships. We've been piloting this now for the past 3 years with a small basic income pilot that initially started with 12 individuals here in the Bay Area. And from that, we were just finalizing a randomized controlled trial with University of Southern California. Yeah. And we'll be sharing the results of that in January. And I'm excited to say that we will be continuing to be able to expand this work over the course of the next 3 years and really understanding how does basic income become the plus to establish relationships and to support individuals as they move from homelessness to housing and to maintain that housing. And so it was just a really important piece for us to, you know, throughout one's journey, these relationships are able to help support people. And that's all I have to say.
Yeah. It's in.
Hi, Sammy Rayner, co-chief executive of Community Forward San Francisco. And we are actually a longstanding organization, been around since 1978. And we really look at providing services along a whole continuum of care for some of our most vulnerable unhoused neighbors. So that looks like two core populations that we serve. Women, anyone who identifies as a woman, as well as those with acute medical or mental health necessity. And so in practice, on any given night, we have as many as 215 people under one of the five different roofs that we have. And that can be services as immediate as a drop-in center for women, the only drop-in center where a woman can go in the middle of the night that will not ask questions and will take her in and provide her safety, all the way up through we offer permanent supportive housing as well. And so along kind of these two pathways, the women's pathway and the medical and mental health pathway, there's increased opportunities for stability. So from that immediate need to a medical shelter where I can get support with, say, I had a major surgery, our medical respite facility can offer stabilization. And really where we're pushing and looking is how can we help people meet their goals for themselves and push and help people push themselves toward housing stability. So in a given month, we could see as many as 600 or more guests across our programs. And I think just kind of reflecting on, George, we had met during the pandemic. I think one of the traditions of Community Forward that's unique is we really respond to crisis. We were one of the city's first agency to run the homeless outreach team, the HOT team, because we recognized San Francisco needed a street response and outreach program. Later in early 2000s, we said, no one's doing a drop-in center for women. We need to make that happen. So that's been a rich part of our history is innovating. And as we look forward, now we're really looking at how do we continue to thread services together for the core populations we serve. So I'll talk more about really specifically about the experience for women who are unhoused. And our work is really looking at how we uniquely make space and make safety available to women and help women move through both co-ed and gender-specific spaces so that women can have opportunity and access to housing.
Thank you. And Erica?
Hi, I'm Erica Kish. I'm the CEO at Compass Family Services. I'm a licensed clinical social worker by training. I've been in social services pretty much all my career and even before that. I was hiding this from my board because I didn't want any fanfare, but I just celebrated my 30-year anniversary at Compass last Friday. So people ask me if I was the founder, but Compass was actually founded in 1914 as Travelers Aid San Francisco, so I'm old, but I'm not that old. And before that, I founded an organization called the Homeless Children's Network that is still around and functioning. So Compass, our mission is to help families that are homeless or at risk of homelessness to achieve housing stability, economic self-sufficiency, and family well-being. We have a broad continuum of programs, and it's growing and expanding as we speak. This past fiscal year, we served 9,628 parents and children, which is a heck of a lot. And obviously, we're going to exceed 10,000 this fiscal year. And it's pretty crazy and not in a good way. So our services are really pretty broad. We're very responsive to need as things change. In the housing realm, we're the Central City Access Point, which is in Civic Center, a family facing a housing crisis. That's how they get into the system, get shelter or problem solving or whatever the services are that are available. Unfortunately, right now, there's more than 530 families waiting for shelter. We've launched a new hotel program funded by the city that's going to be the overflow to the family shelter system. And we're ramping up to 130 hotel rooms for families, which is kind of mixed because I've been around long enough that things kind of come full circle. Back in the day, we just wanted to get out of the hotel business for families because that's not a great place for children to be raised. But right now, it's better than being on the streets. We run permanent supportive housing at the Margot, over at 10th and Mission with our partners Dish and Citywide. And we have a large portfolio of rapid rehousing, different contracts that work in different ways. Some are time limited and some are permanent. And the subsidies are all over the city.
Then we do.
We have a very large behavioral health program supporting families that have trauma, which is a good portion of our families. And our goal is therapy on demand, not like here, get on a waiting list and we'll call you in 6 months. Because when the crisis is now, the crisis is now. We run early childhood education programs for homeless and low-income kids. We do childcare placement for families that are homeless. We have workforce development services and a whole host of other services for families. And we've been just growing and growing the last two fiscal years in crazy ways to just try to keep up with the need that is so great.
Thank you, Erica. And Megan?
Thanks, George. So my name is Megan Freebeck. I'm the director of Simply the Basics. My background is I managed a homeless shelter in Chicago for a few years until moving to San Francisco about 12 years ago. And when I moved here, I took a role as the director of San Francisco Suicide and Crisis Prevention. And it was there that I really came to realize that so many of the people that are facing a crisis, you know, a strategy when somebody is facing a crisis is you can't really respond to them by saying, great, let's solve all of your problems on this phone call. What you do is you connect someone back to their basic human feelings. And oftentimes that's asking someone if they had a meal today. You asked if we had breakfast today. Did you take a shower today? And what was really challenging was we would receive about 300 phone calls every single day from San Franciscans, and over half of them could not respond that they'd been able to access these basic human needs. So these tools that we use to de-escalate, to feel human, to then think about how you could reach these other goals and other needs in your life were simply inaccessible to people. And that was really frustrating. And then I would leave such a hard day job and walk home and find that my walk home was actually the harder part of my day. I think a lot of people in San Francisco and all across the country sadly feel this way. So what I did was I founded the organization Simply the Basics. And we really focused on let's help people just to have access to those needs. We can't expect someone to focus on a greater goal if you don't have your basic human need. And we actually surveyed over 80 organizations in the Bay Area. Almost all of these organizations participated in that survey. So thank you very much for doing that. So that's how Simply the Basics really began to understand that we not only have to make these basic needs predominantly hygiene needs, because there are social service programs that provide things like food, but none that provide hygiene at this time. We need to make them accessible and we need to make it equitable. And we need to make sure that it's new and it's clean and it's diverse and there's choice in what people are getting so that they can focus on what their greater goals are. And so that the staff that are serving them, providing housing and mental health and family connections and safe rest, so that these organizations can work on that. So Simply the Basics is, in short, we think of ourselves like a hygiene bank. However, we are the largest nationally reaching hygiene service. We have partners in over 200 cities. We served our 3 millionth product this year. We have provided to, as a partner, every organization here at this table, which is really wonderful. And we found that 67% of the people we serve reported physical health conditions that are preventable with access to these hygiene needs. So that's our goal. That is really what we're trying to do, is to improve that physical health that comes when you don't have access, to improve the feelings of wellness and dignity when you do have access, to make sure that you have choice, to save our partners time. We saved on average 8 hours of staff time a week last year for all of our receiving sites, because when you're not focused on trying to secure tampons or textured hair shampoo, you can focus on your client's job readiness and mental health and housing programs. So that's what Simply the Basics does. We really believe in a collaborative model. We really believe in working with our partners, working with our receiving sites, and letting the people we serve tell us what they most need so that they can focus on their goal.
Thank you, Megan. And Lydia.
My name is Lydia Branston. I'm the executive director of the Gubbio Project, and I'm incredibly honored to be sitting at the table with these amazing women who have really led the charge. I ride all of your coattails. Our organization is small, hyper-local. We are in a church called St. John's in the Mission. And what we started with 20 years ago off the idea of Father Louis Vitale and Sister Mary Little was opening up church spaces for people to be able to sleep during the day, that people who were sleeping out on the streets in the Tenderloin while churches were sitting empty was something that seemed untenable to Father Louis, who was a fabulous activist in his life. And it was a radical idea. and it still is. There's churches and synagogues and mosques and temples all over the city that sit empty all day long while people are sleeping out on the street. St. John's has a beautiful courtyard as well. So what we do is we open the doors and we welcome people in. People can sleep in the church. People can hang out in the courtyard. We serve coffee all day and snacks. We have bathrooms. But after the pandemic, one of the things that we saw was that the people's need was greater than we were providing. You know, that people were coming to us experiencing extreme neglect with mental health issues, with illnesses, with issues of substance use disorders. People were dying at rates that were alarming. Folks who had been in the community using drugs for decades were dying. Decades. And this has to do with a condition that wasn't being addressed, you know, and an idea that in somehow law and order was going to solve what is a public health issue, right? And so we couldn't stand by and just say, well, you can sleep here, right? While our philosophy is grounded in the fact that without rest, there is no healing, that in order to be able to heal, in order to be able to work on yourself, in order to be able to have a conversation even, you have to be rested because exhaustion is a form of mental illness in itself. We started to work on building partnerships. We were a very small organization with almost no funding. We moved from a Catholic church to an Episcopal church and didn't have, and so we lost about 80% of our funding because we did no longer had a connection to the Catholic funding pool. And we've spent the last 4 years essentially doing a partnership with a purpose, working with Simply the Basics, working with the Department of Public Health, working with the Department of Homelessness and Housing, working with the street teams. That includes HSOC. It's complicated, but if you have people who are moving folks off the street, I want to know when they're going to do that. I want to know that they're coming with resources. I want our folks who are on the street to know that this is going to happen and what they should be prepared for. And knowing that they often had the keys to the housing. The street to housing program came through DPW and DPH. So we were like very, very strategic in making partnerships. We are now a drop-off space for the crisis team. Crisis team brings folks to us. We're a drop-off space for Department of Public Health. We're a drop-off space for BART Police, SFPD. People come to us because they like being in our space, not because they're going to be, you know, put through a system, but rather they just like to be there. So HOT Team comes every morning, the homeless outreach team, and checks in. They give us a list of people that they need to connect with. If we see that person, we call, you know. It's a really simple idea, but it's one of the things that's really lacking in this city is spaces for people to just be. You know, even those folks who we do connect to housing come back to our space. Because putting someone in a home that may be on the other side of the city from their community is often challenging as well. And we have a lot of things we can talk about in that arena. But yeah, I am excited to be here today and thank you so much.
Thank you, Lydia. So just want to back up for one moment because you've just heard five really wonderful individuals who've devoted their lives to helping our unhoused neighbors. If you'd like to dive into each of the backstories, if you will, of the organizations, why I brought the five guests together today was we actually featured them from 2020 to 2023. January 23, we produced 105 episodes on how COVID-19 was impacting nonprofits, small businesses, our local government, and then, of course, our public libraries. So each of their organizations have a full story that we featured back during the depth of the pandemic. So you're welcome to go back and dive into each of those organizations because there's so much more and we'll get into that. So I really wanted to bring them all back together today because here we are in the new market dynamic in the post-pandemic time where funding is harder, politics have gotten rougher. We now have a Supreme Court justice decision that allows cities, counties, and states to just move people from point A to point B, which we know historically does not work. And so I really wanted to bring everyone back together today and just kind of share from each of their perspectives how they're dealing with the new, you know, post-pandemic, which is all still here, you know, fundraising and community engagement, and then what they see the Supreme Court justice decision is impacting their work, along with, we'll get into their recommendations and solutions, and then how you can get engaged. So let's start backwards. I'm going to start with Megan.
Sure. So, you know, just speaking to the change, the shift we've seen since the pandemic, as you mentioned, and you did bring up funding. We did see, you know, a brief time, people really reach out and support organizations, I think, in a big way when the pandemic occurred. However, it's nothing compared to the increased need that we saw. So I will only speak for my organization, but I have a feeling that it's probably echoed a lot in everyone's, which is for every person that, you know, something that's interesting about Simply the Basics is I've been saying for a really long time that hygiene health is public health. And then finally, people believed me that it was important to make sure everyone can wash their hands and be clean and have access to these basics and be indoors and be safe. So while it was nice to not have to convince people anymore, we saw almost quadruple the amount of people reach out to us for support that were not unhoused, but simply lost employment, simply their income changed, simply their needs changed in their household. So it has been a struggle. We're entirely privately funded. So we really do rely on the support and generosity of the community. I think that often when we think about someone in need, it's pretty easy to remember, you know, housing and food are crucial things because we have all felt hunger, right? Like we can feel that in our stomach, but it's not as easy for somebody who's never been without a home or never been without a shower to understand what it feels like to not be able to go into a home when you need it to feel safe. San Francisco just experienced a heat wave. And boy, did I feel gratitude in my heart and in my body that after being outside all day, I had a place I could go home and be indoors and cool and shower and comfortable and safe in. And a lot of the people that we serve don't. So yeah, I would just say that the need has increased tremendously and the pandemic funds have slowed, but the needs have not. And the people who were hit hard during the pandemic, they continue to be hit hard. I will also say that, you know, housing is the priority. And so the more that we can really focus on that is significant. You know, I told my board not to listen, so I'm okay saying that. But that is what we've been needing to see for years. Yeah.
Well, in our first interview with you in the pre-pandemic times, in the Wayback Machine, when you were the ED at, you know, basically Connect, Homeless and Connect, you shared with me, and I used it actually as part of our show, that housing is healthcare. And I thought that was just such, you know, everyone in the panel, of course, is nodding, but I thought it's so much the theme of where we are, you know, and we've decided, sadly, as a country, that it's okay that we have 180,000 plus people in California. 8,000 to 10,000 people in San Francisco, depending on whose numbers you believe.
Yeah, it's absurd. We're still having to convince people of that. Yeah, absolutely.
So, Erica, I want you to share a little bit about how you've been working with families. As I shared with everybody, and when we were doing a little pre-walkthrough, my wife's a teacher, and you know, a very large percentage of her students, you know, from pre-K to fifth grade, live in shelters or RVs, and some of them are lucky if they can get into a safe place. But I'm not sure if you know the statistics of what's the percentage of unhoused community members that are actually families and children.
Yeah, I think about a third of homeless individuals are in families, and that's parents and children and toddlers and infants and pregnant people who have no place to stay. Just kind of the conversations take me back, and I'm sitting here thinking about that COVID time and the response. And boy, that was a terrible time. And I could not have been prouder about how, like, Compass kind of turned everything upside down and showed up to deal with the pandemic and to do things in incredibly creative ways to support families in terrible need. Like, from day one of, you know, the shelter in place, families unable to feed their kids and unable to pay their rent and all those jobs that parents typically do were going away, you know, in the hospitality industry and in restaurants and, you know, doing housekeeping in people's homes. So it was just pretty unbelievable, as we all know, but we did so much, and our fundraising, you know, COVID was good for our fundraising, I have to say. And our fundraising is not necessarily suffering right now, but what everyone's saying is the need has increased so tremendously. So from 2019 till now, the number of families seeking our services has increased 100%. And in the last 2 years, they've increased 36%. We have, you know, we can have 150 families coming through the doors of our Family Resource Center. We have one of two Family Resource Centers in San Francisco specifically targeting families that are homeless. And 150 families coming through the door looking for support, looking for services, looking to have their basic needs met. And it's just been a struggle to maintain the quality when you're trying to handle the quantity. So that's something that, you know, we've really been trying to figure out. But, you know, the pandemic ended, but it didn't really end for the families we serve. So many jobs that never came back. The price of food, the price of gas, and then the public supports that kind of snuck away, you know, everyone got used to, okay, we can reduce the child poverty rate to 7.5% from 19% if we, you know, have this CalFresh and this eviction moratorium and the tax credit. And that really worked. That was working, but, you know, those were removed. So little by little, you know, families that were kind of stabilizing themselves with these extra things, just becoming destabilized. So
I just want to follow up because I think one of the things that I realized in talking to all of you and or your organizations during the pandemic and so many other nonprofits is obviously the pandemic accelerated all of the causes that were out there for decades. But I love the fact that, you know, we said we couldn't do things like, you know, hotel and motel rooms, and then we magically did it. We said we couldn't, you know, stop evictions, and then we magically did it. So, you know, Cheryl, I know you just finished that you're back into hotels and motels, but if you participated in Project Home Key and all of that during the pandemic, what were some of the findings that came out of that?
Yeah. You know, one of the things we did, there were so many things to support families during the pandemic, is we stood up a hotel. You remember that hotels weren't being used for their normal purposes. So there was a vacant hotel that we were able to rent all the rooms in. And the prioritization, and it's hard to even remember this because I've tried to kind of block it out, but the prioritization for families was more about like if there was some kind of special medical need. So, but who doesn't have a medical need when you've got children and babies and you're pregnant during a global pandemic? So we took 30 families that were sheltering in place in like storefronts or on the street, and we put them into this hotel, completely privately funded. You know, we set up a meal system. We brought in case management. We did this with a couple of partners, and we committed to not one of those families was going to be exited to the streets at the end of the shelter in place. And we were able to pull that off. And we put this in place in like a couple of weeks. So it can be done. It totally can be done. And, you know, what's happening right now with this kind of reversion to using hotels as part of the shelter system, again, it's better than being on the street, certainly, but, you know, the idea of children being raised in hotel rooms where they don't have a kitchen, where they don't have, you know, their own space, it's not fantastic. And obviously, housing is the most important thing, permanent housing for every family. And that's where we need to go.
Thank you.
As we reach the heart of our conversation, let's take a moment to thank the sponsors who make this show possible. Their support allows us to spotlight the organizations and individuals dedicated to addressing homelessness and uplifting our community. This discussion is only possible through the backing of these wonderful sponsors and by viewers and listeners like you, who believe in building a more inclusive and compassionate society. Voices of the Community is made possible by generous support from the Zillerbach Family Foundation, dedicated to ensuring vibrant work is created, new voices celebrated, and diverse communities have opportunities to thrive. Learn more at zff.org. Voices of the Community is also supported by the Peaceful World Foundation, fostering a culture of global peace through hosted conversations and education. Discover more at peacefulworldfoundation.org. Thank you for supporting today's episode. Now back to our panel as we continue exploring the pathways and partnerships that can make housing and resources more accessible to our unhoused neighbors.
And then, Sammy, I really want you to dive a little bit deeper on a couple of things. One, women and the impact of being unhoused and, you know, for women in our community, but also a big component of that is spousal abuse as well. besides everyone thinking it's mental health, it's drugs, et cetera, that's a big driver of it. So I want you to share about that and share how someone who comes into your system, you know, what is the steps for them to reinvent, if you will, their lives?
Yeah, thank you. And October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. So yeah, important time to just be educating ourselves because it is much more prevalent, I think, than that it's an issue that gets hidden very easily. And kind of putting all of this in context with the pandemic, we saw a rise in homelessness among women and anyone who identifies as a woman, as well as our gender nonconforming community through the pandemic. Homelessness has been on the rise at double the rate among women and girls as among men and boys during the pandemic. And a huge driver of that is, you know, all these things Erica's talking about, loss of key family resources, women having to stay home and increased stress in the home is, you know, creates this really scary reality and nowhere to go, right? Like having to be home all day long, even, you know, a woman who is in an unsafe relationship who could go to the store, go out to go to work, like have a break from a violent situation, isn't getting that space. And we are seeing on the other side of that, the impact, and through the pandemic, seeing not just who you think of as who's a tip, like an unhoused homeless woman, but, you know, talking to our guests who are, one woman who was a substitute teacher and she was sleeping at our drop-in center because she had nowhere else to go. So I think understanding that, you know, about a third, 38% of the homeless population in San Francisco, that's over 3,000 women, are on our streets every single night. And what we're really working on is how can we increase the level of investment in women-only spaces. We always are doing, you know, street outreach surveys. One of the surveys we did, we talked to 106 women in our community and asked, where do you feel safe? The number one answer from women who are, you know, actively homeless living on the street, the number one answer was nowhere. The number two answer was with other women. And so we at Community Forward have really, we have been the place and the safety net that will, you know, take women, no questions asked, no wait lists, meet that need. And we really are trying to chart a path forward so that we have more of those spaces. Because right now, only 5% of San Francisco's homeless response system, so that's shelters, transitional housing, permanent housing, only 5% of the spaces are gender specific. Not that gender specific is the answer for every single woman, but I think we need to give a little more than 5% to say that we're seeing this population and they are not seen in the point in time count. A woman surviving on the street is not going to be seen in the middle of the night. She is actively going to hide or look like a man, you know, to disguise herself to be safe, because 80% of unhoused women report abuse as one of the causes of their homelessness. So I think, you know, just to kind of wrap it all up, for us, it's about having, again, our drop-in spaces, that immediate safety. One example, a client who was recently in our care, I'll call her Darlene. A lot of the women we work with are so traumatized, they're nonverbal when they first come in. And so they're not able to come in and say, yes, this is exactly the 5 services that I need. You know, it's about community and it's about rapport building and relationship building to create opportunities to engage further. And so our amazing director at our drop-in just, you know, had this eye on her. She came, she sat in front of the director's door every day and just slowly built that rapport, realized that she actually qualified and was a great fit for our transitional housing program. And so she was able to move from that kind of emergency overnight space into our transitional housing program that has much more robust services, mental health support. You know, we can help you with workforce readiness. We can help you look at your benefits that you should be getting, really come around our guests with a holistic approach and support of services. But yes, definitely, I think one more stat, because it is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. 1 in 4 women will have an instance or will experience an instance of violence or assault in their lifetime. So that means of the women on this stage, 2 or 3, you know, 1 or 2 of us, you know, could have had that experience. And it is so important, no matter whether you're in focused on women like we are, or especially in co-ed response to homelessness, to just see what a woman might be holding in her experience.
Thank you, Sammy. Mary, I'm going to turn to you. And for folks, Mary had mentioned Ray, and Ray was actually, so Kevin Adler, who's the founder of Miracle Money, and then, well, his first Miracle Messages, has been on the show 3 times. And we featured Ray during the pandemic. I think it was 2021, actually. And it's a really wonderful story about Ray and his daughter and his volunteer, Jen, who worked with him, et cetera. So, you know, one of the things that I love about, you know, what Miracle Messages has been doing, which I was first introduced to Kevin by Megan, because I was thinking about, like, how can we give folks money? Because I loved, hand up. Was just the fact that, you know, you're one of the solutions of bringing families back together. But also, you know, for folks in the audience, we did a documentary series on Stockton, and Michael Tubbs was mayor at the time, did the first with Chris, who is the co-founder of Facebook. What a counterbalance to Mark Zuckerberg, who had a foundation work with Michael Tubbs to do the first UBI, Universal Basic Income, in Stockton, to give people money each month to show that they weren't going to go buy drugs, big TV, you know, et cetera. They actually paid their utilities, fixed their car, you know, et cetera, took care of healthcare. But share with us, you know, some of the solutions that you've seen, and then I'll turn to Lydia, and then we'll get into the solutions part of it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think some of the solutions that we've been seeing, I think we talked about the reunion services that we're providing in supporting individuals and reconnecting with their families. Let me back up, actually. Let me start with that. So we think there's 2 parts of our mission. One is that nobody has to experience homelessness alone. And the other part is that nobody has to feel hopeless around the issue of homelessness. And so our organization has just a couple of incredible full-time employees, but we are really built off of the support of an incredible network of volunteers. And these are And so I think that is a way of really engaging individuals who are, you know, our housed community, and being part of the solution, and also being a part of challenging one's perceptions around what is homelessness, why do people experience homelessness, and, you know, and why the challenges of people moving out of homelessness and then maintaining their life outside of homelessness. And so I think that that's one important piece of what we're doing. We do that through the reunion work. So really connecting people to their loved ones. And then I think that is incredibly important right now as we are seeing things, you know, from the grants pass. There's a lot of efforts across the country, both here in San Francisco, California, and, you know, we have one of our colleagues in Florida that's also trying to support county and city and county governments, really trying to reconnect people with their loved ones. And we're really trying to think about, how do we utilize our experience and really doing this in a person-centered way, so that we're making sure that the individual who's experiencing homelessness interests are at first and foremost. And so one of the things that we do is we provide people with a 2-way bus ticket, so that when they reunify with their family that they haven't seen in 10, 15 years, they don't have to necessarily move in permanently. They can come back home, and then they can both come back to here in San Francisco and reassess and decide what other services, or are they really ready to make that transition back into their home? Because our goal is not just we really want them to reconnect, but not to do so in a way that then results in that family not being set up for success in the long run. Then we also look at the relational supports that we provide around engaging our housed community and our unhoused community neighbors and getting to know each other through these Miracle Friends, which brought those relationships like Ray and Jenny. We have other individuals who are, you know, who've been friends now for 4+ years, where these are we have our natural support system that gets established. And so you have your case managers who are there wrapping around individuals, and you have your housing case managers and your medical social workers. But who are you going to call and talk to? Like, you're not talking to your case manager about like how, you know, what are all of those like intricate little things that you need to do in your life? And so our friends are able to come in and be literally that, like the friends and family for individuals. And so that leads to opportunities for people to be supported and like gathering, you know, as they moved into housing in Hayward and they don't actually have access to transportation, how are they able to navigate getting those food delivered to their home? How are they able to navigate those challenging relationships that they have with their landlord at really odd times of the day? And so these friendships are able to help support people through those journey, through that journey. And then again, the basic income. I think we are really trying to look at how does money help support people? Not, and it really has to be the plus. Like as you're starting to see a lot of researches coming out right now that was really thinking that like basic income was going to be the silver bullet. And like, you don't need all these other social service supports, but it is like, basic income is in addition to all the other services, and that allows for an individual to have a little bit more breathing room while they're navigating some challenges. And so I think we're able to really lean into and help identify the benefit of that. We've been able to start to show the results of that, and we're going to be able to continue to show that moving forward and think about how this basic income becomes part of the solution. So those are just a few examples. So
over the years since Kevin launched, and maybe Megan remembers how many years ago it was, but how many folks has messages brought family members back together that have actually stayed kind of together and worked?
Yes, we've supported 1,000 reunifications since we started for the past 10 years. And our goal is to make that the next 10 years to be able to support 10,000 families. So we're looking at trying to expand that.
Nice. And then how many folks like Ray who... Mm-hmm. was so proud to actually have a place to live that he could call his own. And so the whole idea of money completely changed his relationship. He shared about going to his daughter's college graduation, et cetera. So, you know, how many folks' lives have you changed through direct income?
Yes, we've supported just under 140 individuals in getting basic income supports since we started. Yeah.
And then of those, how many of them have some form of semi-permanent or housing?
Yeah. So individuals were twice as likely to move to nights spent unsheltered because of the basic income. But that's not we don't have the exact number of like how many people actually moved into housing. The initial pilot, which was 12 individuals, 65% of them were able to move into permanent housing. So so we're still finalizing what that looks like for the current RCT. So,
well, the hardest part of the entire equation is there's just not enough places for people to move into.
And it's also math too.
Right, right.
So, you know, we provide $750 to individuals for 12 months in California. It's around like, what are those other services that are being provided? Now, when we did the initial pilot where there was the 12 individuals and they had 65% of them, that was also during the relief funds that were coming in during the COVID and during the pandemic. And so things looked a lot different than they do right now. So.
Yep. Yes, all that money was really wonderful, and now we don't need to do the tax credit or CalFresh.
Yeah,
it's all going to happen.
Yeah,
I'm going to come to you, Lydia, because when I dropped off the sleeping cots and we first met at the church again, you were just talking. At that point, you guys were kind of working on a relationship with the city that would allow you to kind of scale up some of your wraparound services that you talked about. So, how is that going?
It's going really well. We have secured a contract with the Department of Public Health to move our hours from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., which is going to be really great. And also to be able to have resources in terms of more staff to be able to connect with our folks, including a wellness coordinator and folks who are working on substance use disorder specialists, having folks who are going to be able to go out into our direct community and encourage people to come and visit our site, see if they want to hang out. But I wanted to turn around for one second because we were talking about fundraising and charity. And I think one of the most important things that I learned over the pandemic, you know, charity is good. Giving people funding for projects that improve people's lives is a really good thing. But what was different about the pandemic was you had federal money, the big bucks, the real money, right? Coming in where it's not like you're having to like pick and choose which foundation, the infrastructure of fundraising is in itself a huge burden on organizations. Small organizations like the Gubbio Project, where I'm the fundraiser and sometimes the toilet cleaner. And, you know, we are embedded in the community. I don't see myself as having an office, you know, in another place. We are an organization that's embedded in a community that already exists, right? And so the greater need for the community has to do with like the fact that there's huge income inequality. The fact that we're having to rely on people who have made vast amount of money to be charitable in a direction that they find appealing, right, is in itself problematic. And so it's like, when are we as a society going to say that housing is a right, not a privilege? And it shouldn't be dispersed to us based on like whether or not we can show up to an appointment with our counselor, right? Because a lot of the folks cannot. The folks that we work with on a daily basis are people who are going to be cared for their entire lives. They have been to treatment. They have been to jail. They have been to social workers. They have been to counselors, right? And still they are unstable. Society, where do we as a society have a place for these people? You know, we talk about giving people dignity. In my learning, people have dignity, and that respect is our acknowledgement of that dignity. And so when I say we're embedded in a community that already exists, I didn't create this community. I opened the doors and allowed the community to come in and said, what do you need? Right? And I think as a society, when you ask, you know, what are the solutions? It has to do with a sea change in how we see people, that people aren't a burden. You know, when you walk down the street and you see a group of people using drugs together, people are like, oh my God, look at those people. They're all using drugs. They're just feeding off this. I mean, the language that's used about people. I mean, this is still a community. And the vast amount of people who have overdoses reversed are done by other people using drugs with them. People use drugs together for safety. We talk about drug use, but we don't talk about the cause. Why are people wanting to be obliterated? Why? They didn't wake up that way. My kid's 16. Thankfully, she doesn't use drugs yet. Hopefully never. But, you know, she didn't, her goal in life isn't to like use drugs, be on the street. She has goals. All of these people have had goals. They all had desires and they have different challenges. And I think the way we show up, not just as community organizations, but as a society needs to change. You know, and that's a huge ask, but we saw it during the pandemic, right? So, and like you said, like all of those things that helped us, the money for food disappeared, right? The money for the housing and the hotels disappeared. All that tap was turned off. I mean, I sat in a meeting with City Hall where they were talking about, hey, the tap is turning off. We're going to have a huge budget deficit. We can do it. So if you want to know how to change it, you have to like want to change it and not continue putting band-aids on it.
Thank you. Wonderful segue to the next part of our conversation. I'm going to turn to you, Erica. So the focus on this part of the conversation is from our panelists, from their perspective and where they sit, you know, what are some of the solutions that they have seen, worked on, would like to see? We're in an election season, obviously. We have stuff coming up in the state and the city and county ballot. So what are some of the things that you've done, that you'd like to do, that you'd like to see the city and county do to support our unhoused families?
I'm glad you asked that because I wanted to follow up about universal basic income, which is one of the solutions that I think is showing so much promise. And so Compass is actually doing a research project, us and Hamilton Families, in partnership with Google, who's the funder, and NYU, who's the research partner. We are providing families that are 6 months from exiting their subsidy. So remember, I said that some of the rental subsidies are time limited. And we're providing them with $1,000 a month for a year. And we're trying to kind of see what impact that has on them at that vulnerable time when the subsidy is being taken away and they need to be able to pay their rent and keep self-sufficiency. And, you know, it's too early to tell in terms of the results. We expect they will be positive. There's a whole body of studies that have been done, and pretty much all of them show that people use the money for the right things, to take care of their business, to take care of their families, and that it does make a difference. And the supports that were put in place during the pandemic are actually the same thing, guaranteed income. And what do you know? They actually really made a difference. So a plug for guaranteed basic income as a solution because, you know, we need to be creative. We need to do different things because what we're doing isn't really working all that well. Another thing that we did this past year is we were very involved in trying to challenge the homeless count for families, which was always just ridiculously underreported. So like if we've served almost 10,000 families in a year and there's like 113 classrooms worth of homeless children in San Francisco Unified School District, how could the homeless count show that there are 130 families in San Francisco that are homeless? So, you know, really kind of pushed with partners and the city agreed to partner with us. And so we came up with a count that was 90% higher than the previous count, but we also still know that it's extremely undercounted nonetheless. But, you know, right on the heels of that information being released, Mayor Breed unveiled her Safer Families plan, which does bring more resources to play for addressing family homelessness. So that was definitely very affirming and inspiring, and we need to keep at that. I mean, kind of more generally, I think just the notion that nobody wants homeless people, nobody wants homelessness, but nobody wants homeless people anywhere near them, and nobody wants housing for homeless people in their neighborhood. So like everybody needs to be like just challenging that because it's just impossible and ridiculous. I mean, it's the most basic of things, but you know, it's just impossible. What else? Again, we are just trying to grow some of our more specialized services, do things that are a little more creative and outside the box to serve more families. We just secured private funding that I'm really excited about because we have 13 programs that address family homelessness and target families that are homeless, but they're not all housing programs. So like if we have a family in our behavioral health services whose housing is unstable or who doesn't have housing but isn't in one of our housing programs, how are they going to move forward in terms of securing housing? So we were able to secure from a very generous donor funding to hire three dedicated housing locators who are going to be working with the families that aren't in our housing program specifically to get to secure housing and to kind of like, you know, move along on the path towards housing. And that is really exciting. We're getting ready to hire those folks. We're doing more dedicated services for parenting TAY. So transitional age youth, 18 to 25, who have children, but are at a different developmental stage than some of the other parents we serve. And, you know, we've always known that. And so we have like a targeted case management program and supports for that population. Again, we got to be creative. We have to do things differently. It's such a crisis. We have to just pull out all the stops on solutions.
So follow up two things, Erica. First, from your vantage point and your own data, what is a realistic number of unhoused families in San Francisco right now?
You know, it's so hard. That's like, I've been doing this so long and it's such a disgrace that I can't really answer that question easily because, you know, there's the HUD definition of homelessness and then there's the San Francisco definition of homelessness and they're not the same. All the families in SRO hotels that are doubled or tripled up living with friends or family, those aren't counted in the HUD definition. They are counted in the San Francisco definition, but none of those families will ever make it to the top of the list so that they can get shelter or housing because there's so much need. So even though they are technically homeless by San Francisco definition, they will not get the services they need. So I'm evading your question.
No, it's hard. I mean, in diving into it, because I'm a data junkie as well, I mean, one of the numbers I found really fascinating is 6 out of 10 folks in the latest point of count were residents of San Francisco who used to have housing who are now unhoused.
Yep.
Right? So, I mean, It's just, you know, the people, you know, the narrative that, oh, people are coming from out of town because they want to, you know, utilize all of our social services, et cetera. I mean, these are San Franciscan residents who, you know, became unhoused. A lot of them are seniors. Yeah. A lot of them are people of color. A lot of them are women, et cetera.
Yeah. And I live in Oakland and it's really the same thing, you know, people who grew up in Oakland, and there's so much kind of movement between the East Bay and San Francisco, so it's hard to really say Oakland, Berkeley, San Francisco. It's all kind of one big community, but they grew up and now they're on the streets because they can't afford to live there anymore.
So is there something, you know, some piece of legislation, because now everybody's throwing out candy to become the next mayor, right? So is there some piece of legislation or some legislation that you would like to see that the supervisors and whoever happens to be the mayor can do? Or is there anything on the ballot here in 2-3 weeks that people can vote for that would actually change it on the street?
Well, you know, there needs to be more permanent housing. There needs to be more permanent housing. And there's a lot of, I think, kind of back and forth about shelter, no housing, no shelter, no housing. But we actually need all of it. We need both of it. And the other area that, you know, folks should be paying attention to is this, you know, the Grants Pass decision and the idea that if you don't have a place to live, even though we're not going to let you live anywhere near us, you don't have a right to exist. And 29% of the families that come to us needing shelter are sleeping in vehicles and living in vehicles. Yet there are 530 families counting, probably more since I got here, that are waiting for shelter. So what are we thinking? What are we thinking?
Thank you for joining us in this essential conversation about the realities and solutions for homelessness in San Francisco. We invite you to further support the impactful work of the organizations represented by our panelists today. These organizations work tirelessly to provide critical services, advocate for meaningful policy changes, and contribute to building a more equitable and compassionate society. To learn more about our panelists and their organizations, visit voicesofthecommunity.com and click on Making the Invisible Visible to explore Episode 1. While you're there, subscribe to our newsletter to stay updated, and if you feel moved by our conversation, please consider supporting these efforts by donating or volunteering. We've also created a YouTube playlist featuring our past interviews with each organization participating in today's live panel show, which you can find on the Making the Invisible Visible Episode 1 page, or simply search George Koster on YouTube to dive into the playlist and learn more about each organization's unique approach and contributions to supporting our unhoused neighbors. Mark your calendars and join us again on December 7th for part 2 of our live panel discussion, Finding Home, where we will take a deeper look into the experiences, services, and solutions that support our community members on their journey towards stable housing. Together, we can make a difference for our unhoused neighbors and work toward our San Francisco where everyone has a place to call home. Today's episode was made possible through our amazing technical crew, audio and video wizard Eric Strada, and our co-production partner, Bayvac Media, and their wonderful team, Paula Argoni, Andy Kunami, Siobhan Giles, and Clay Go. And thanks to Casey Nance from Citron Studios for the graphics magic. A special thanks to our broadcast partners who help share these important conversations, KSFP LPFM in San Francisco, KPCA LPFM in Petaluma, Petaluma Community Public Access TV, and Bayvac Media's SF Commons Public Access TV. Thank you for your commitment to amplifying diverse voices and perspectives. Please support these partners and our mission by tuning in and spreading the word. Voices of the Community is made possible by generous support from the Zellerbach Family Foundation, dedicated to ensuring vibrant work is created, new voices celebrated, and diverse communities have opportunities to thrive. Learn more at zff.org. We're also supported by the Peaceful World Foundation, fostering a culture of global peace through hosted conversations and education. Discover more at peacefulworldfoundation.org. And we'd love your support to continue to make shows just like this one. Go to georgekoster.com and click on the donate button. Take Voices of the Community with you on the go. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Enjoying the show? Please rate and review us. It helps more people discover these important stories. Watch past and future episodes on YouTube by searching for Geo Koster. Have feedback or ideas? We'd love to hear from you. Email george@georgekoster.com. I'm George Koster from San Francisco. On behalf of our team, thank you for joining us. Until next time, remember, your voice matters.